The first case of the day is Johnson v. Cypress Hill, Appeal 0838-3810 and others. We'll first hear from Mr. Morrison.
Good morning. Excuse me. Good morning. I'm Douglas Morrison, and I represent Sill Johnson. This is a case in which we are dealing with an issue of the interests of justice. It's undisputed that Sill Johnson is the owner of two sound recordings of the song, Is It Because I'm Black? He recorded one in 1968. He recorded a second one in 1972. He was the person who was a co-songwriter of the song. He also paid the musicians, arranged the studio time, and is the owner of the recordings. He learned in 2003 that his song had been used by a group called Cypress Hill on an album called Black Sunday. The song was copied, and although the defendants tried to belittle the amount by saying it was only a 2.5-second segment of the song that was used, in fact, that 2.5-second segment, if it was in fact 2.5 seconds, was repeated on and became the entire song interlude on the album Black Sunday. So it isn't as if we're talking about a 2.5-second piece of a song. We're talking about an entire song that's just Mr. Johnson's music and playing music on for the entire length of the song. That is the song interlude. When Mr. Johnson learned of this, he filed a pro se lawsuit alleging copyright infringement. He believed at the time that he had a copyright, he had obtained a copyright on the 1972 version of the song, of the sound recording, and believed that that was the item that had been copied and placed as the song interlude. Case went into litigation. He filed the initial complaint pro se. He got counsel a few months later. It was amended to clear up some technical defects. But for the most of the time of the litigation, it was the belief of Mr. Johnson and his counsel that it was the 1972 copyright that was violated.
This was all just on memory, I suppose.
It wasn't just memory. The fact is
his memory meaning.
I'm sorry?
His memory. Nobody apparently checked it out. So.
Well, it wasn't a matter to check out. What happened was that was the only song. That version was the only version that was in circulation. The earlier version, the 68 version, the 45 RPM version, you know, with the big hole, the 35 was on a company called Twinight Records. Twinight Records was out of business. There was no copies of that song in circulation. It's only its only distribution was in the 45 RPM format. On the other hand, the other song had been recorded. It had not been released in the United States, but it was readily available as an import on the P-Vine label from Japan. Had he heard it?
Heard the interlude, the song, the interlude?
He heard it in 2003, just before he filed his lawsuit. He hadn't heard it before then.
Okay. Well, was there any explanation for why that song was not included in the copyright application?
He doesn't understand why. But actually, Your Honor...
Did somebody prepare it for him?
No, he prepared it himself.
He prepared it himself.
He prepared it himself, and he was certain that it was on there. This was his biggest hit record. This would be the one song he would be assured that he put on there, because that's the one he would put on. But as things turned out...
Yeah, but that's what seems so bizarre here, because it's the apparently the number 9 song at one time on charts.
Yeah, it was a hit. It was a hit.
So the lesser hits, quote, those were included in the application for copyright, but this one was not.
But he believed it was, and it was on the list of songs on the copyright application.
But believing
somehow,
it...
It wasn't, it somehow it didn't make it on the tape, or it got erased in the process at some point. Not sure.
But believing it does doesn't get you very far here.
Well, the problem is that it doesn't matter at this point, because in October of 2007, at the deposition of one of the Cypress Hill members, and this is why this whole tape thing, it really has become a red herring. At the deposition of Mr. Muggeroot, who's one of the members of the group Cypress Hill, he testified that what he copied was a 45 RPM version of the song. That 45 RPM version, the only 45 RPM version of that song, was the Twinight Records, the 1968 recording of Is It Because I'm Black. And the law says that the 1968 recording, it was recorded too early to get a registered sound recording copyright. So we are not dealing, at that point, when we heard that, when we learned that from Mr. Muggeroot, after doing a little research to be sure that this was the only 45 RPM that would ever be recorded, that ever was recorded, we went ahead and we determined at this point that federal law didn't matter anymore. The federal copyright registration didn't matter anymore. Pursuant to the copyright law, if there was state protection on a sound recording that was recorded prior to February of 1972, and if there is state law protection will cover until, I think, the year 2067. On that basis, everybody involved in this case, the plaintiffs, the co-plaintiff's lawyer, the defense lawyers on the case, everybody realized that we were now dealing with...
You've said that in your reply brief, Mr. Morrison. I'm wondering what evidence there is in the record that everybody, especially the defense or the district court, was assuming that this was now a state law claim.
At the time that the amended complaint, our request for an amended complaint was denied, it had already been raised in our answer to the motion for summary judgment. So it was out there. That was in March. It was definitely out there. It was discussed. These were settlement discussions. You don't put that on the record. There were settlement discussions. We were preparing a pretrial order just in case the settlement discussion did not bear fruit. And all of this was in there. I mean, everyone knew. It's hard to say, do I have anything in the record? Probably not, other than the answer to the motion for summary judgment, which clearly says this is based on state court. Yes, Mr. Johnson, when we found out in 2007 that it was the Twinight record that was admittedly taken, used, put on the record, and no compensation and it's Mr. Johnson's property that has been used. It's continuing to be used today. And, as a result, and once we found that out, we were still discussing settlement. We were still discussing the pretrial order with that as the linchpin of that particular part of the case.
And why not just concede the federal copyright claim in your response to summary judgment?
I did.
And say?
I did.
You did?
I did.
Okay.
I did. I said there is no copyright. I did. I mean, it's in there. We said that his protection is now state law.
Did anyone listen to the interlude? I'm a little bit confused. Between the 1968 version, which is the one they used off an old 45 record, and whatever later one, did Mr. Johnson sing the later one as well?
Yes. It was recorded by...
If he were to listen, he couldn't tell the difference between then and the next time.
Differences were slight. Okay. He recorded it with the same...
Not enough. It wasn't like it was a different singer or somebody else using the song.
Same musicians.
Okay.
He brought in the same band. It was only three or four years later. He brought in the same band, the same people, even recorded it in the same studio. So there were, he did it because he knew the law changed. Mr. Johnson knows his business, and he knew the law changed. He knew he was entitled to a sound recording protection if he recorded it after I guess it was February of 72. And that's why he did it. Unfortunately here, the version that was purloined, if I can say so, was the version that isn't entitled to sound recording copyright registration. It is entitled to protection under state law. And that's what the amended complaint was all about. Once we were informed of that, and once Judge Norgel held the summary judgment in abeyance, we thought we better get this done. We were originally planning either to settle the case or get it in the pretrial order, which would have had the same implication. You know, we would have gotten it in the pretrial order, and it would have the state law case would have or the state law claim would have been available for the trial.
Other than statute of limitations, are there any other elements in the state law that would not have been covered in the federal copyright law?
I don't think so. I think that's one of the obvious questions.
It's a new claim, and there's going to be more discovery and more.
I don't think that there would have been more discovery, or certainly nothing significant. There was nothing set out in either their motion or their objection to our amended complaint, or in Judge Norgel's order, just saying there would be. And then it turns out, if in their brief, they said what they were looking for was an expert to say that sampling stolen music has some kind of public interest, and they were going to try to find an expert to say that. Well, that would have been a good expert to cross-examine, I think.
Have you known that there was no federal copyright here?
Right.
At the beginning, this case would never have gone to federal court.
No. What would have happened?
You filed it in state court, and it was removed.
No. We couldn't do it that way.
No. You would have only had a state court claim, and you would not have been in federal court at all. Unless there's diversity here, and I'm not sure that there was.
Well, there is diversity. But that's not exactly true. What would have happened here? Let's say they made a point in their brief that there was some kind of notice in 06 that this song didn't exist on the tape, therefore there's no copyright on that thing. Well, if we would have believed that to be true at the time, and we didn't, but if we would have believed that to be true at the time, what we would have done was taken a non-suit, Mr. Johnson would have gone ahead and gotten the copyright, and then we would have refiled in federal court, kind of like that Hallstrom case that Justice Thomas talked about in the case that I missed when I was doing my research. That's what would have happened, and then we would have been back here anyway, because later on it would have been determined that wasn't the version that was stolen, and we would have had to go back to the same amended complaint we have now. So that's why this whole idea of the tape and the missing song on the tape, really, in the context of where we are now in this case, is a red herring. It's not an issue that's of any real moment right now, which is why in the answer to the motion for summary judgment, just said it doesn't matter. He can't get a copyright on a 1968 recording. And that's why he has to use the state law. So what we have here, and now with respect to filing the amended complaint, of course, what we're talking about is the right under the rule to freely amend the complaint in the interest of justice. Here it's clearly in the interest of justice. There wasn't any real delay involved in this case. We learned about it in
you're 4 years into the case.
But we didn't. I'm sorry. Yes, we're 4 years into the case, but we're not.
4 years into the case till you know about the basis of your own claim.
Because only they knew which version they stole.
Well, it was public, right?
No, but only they knew which version they stole. We didn't know that they stole the 68 version. We thought they stole the 72 version.
What's the difference?
In the sound, virtually nothing.
Yeah.
So how would we know?
I mean, you said the 68 version was based on an old 45.
We wouldn't have been able to know. That's what I'm saying. We wouldn't have been able to know. We couldn't tell just by listening. But when the defendant, who finally gave a deposition, and there was problems getting that deposition. It wasn't anything we needed motions for, but this was an active rock group that was around all the time, and we finally had to get the deposition in California. Once we got it, for the first time, it was 4 years of them concealing which version they used. It wasn't us.
Well, if you can't tell the difference, how do you know what version you used?
Because the defendant admitted it.
What's the guy's name here?
Mr. Muggerud.
Yeah.
Who's the lead guy of Cypress Hill. And at his deposition, he told the story of how this song was on Interlude, how Interlude was produced. He found the record, 45, in a used record bin in Brooklyn, New York. He liked it so much, he put it on his machine and then put it on the record. We didn't know until, and couldn't really know, until Mr. Muggeridge gave his deposition in October of 07, I believe it was. We couldn't know which version was stolen.
Even if it were the 72 version, let's just assume that, you would still have a state law claim, wouldn't you?
No. No, it would clearly be preempted by copyright law.
You mean that law is obsolete then, as once the copyright came in?
Yes. Yeah, that's why that's why they put in this provision that if your case isn't covered under copyright law, because they knew it preempted everything in the ahead, you have until 2067 to file your state law claim on a sound recording. If there's state law protections, which there are in Illinois, you have till 2067 there coverage for that.
So under the state, under the race judicata theory, where it's a claim preclusion issue, you should have included it. You're saying you could not include it under the 1972 version?
I could not put the 1972 version into state court, right. The 1972 version, what I would have had to do is what I said a moment ago. We would have had to pull back, take a voluntary non-suit on the present case, get the copyright, and then file it. Because you can recover damages for violations of copyrights prior to your registration. And that's what we would have ended up having to do. But because it was the 68 version, there was no ability to get a copyright. It just didn't exist. The 68 version, you cannot get a sound recording registration for a song that was fixed in 1968. We also had, as part of the amended complaint, the songwriter's copyright, which Judge Norgal had approved and allowed to proceed with respect to the co-songwriters Watson Jones. That count certainly was litigated throughout the case. All this had been litigated throughout the case. There was really nothing new. So, you know, I have to, you know, just assume that that at this point, and again, I'm on my rebuttal time now, so I think I better stop. But again, this is a matter where the amended complaint that we sought to file didn't change anything but the basis of liability from the federal copyright law to the state misappropriation laws. Same damages, same parties, same song, same everything. There was no reason to deny that motion. There was no delay, and there was clearly no prejudice to the defendants. And I believe that Judge Norgal erred when he denied that, and as a result of denying the allowing the second amended complaint to be filed, all these other errors proceeded. That gets rectified. Everything else goes away. Thank you.
For the defense, Mr. Bard.
Thank you. May it please the Court. My name is Andrew Bart from Jenner & Block, and I'm representing the defendants' appellees in this matter. I think we have to start off with one simple fact, that there was never any good faith question about what version of the song we sampled. We licensed the 1969 version from the prior owner of Twilight Records. We put a defense in our original action, our original answer, saying we have a license for this use. That was the subject of a summary judgment motion in 2006. We were on record from the very beginning of this action saying that we licensed the 69 work, that that was what was at issue, that we had a complete defense, and that that motion was then addressed by the court. As part of that motion for summary judgment, Peter Wright, the gentleman who we got the license from, did what appellant never did, which is to go to the copyright office and to find out what was filed. One of the reasons why the appellant focuses so heavily on this notion of Mr. Muggeridge's deposition is because they don't want the court to ask the question, why didn't you check your own copyright filing? This is a matter of public record. It's their case, their claim, and at various points, Mr. Wright and then the defendants went in and obtained copies of both the application and the deposit copy of what was filed with the Copyright Office, and the plaintiff's song wasn't there. They brought an action here. They said they believed that there was a second claim. Whatever they think they believed doesn't matter. They didn't engage in the requisite due diligence to provide a foundation for their claim. In 2006, for the first time, I might add, in response to the summary judgment motion, when they realized that, oh, there's an issue here in terms of license, they came up with this argument about a subsequent 1972 sound recording. Contrary to what Mr. Morrison suggested, we do not concede that there were two versions of the song. We think there was only one version of the song and that it was released somewhere else a second time. That issue has never been decided by anybody. This whole issue of we created mysteriously a second version in 1972 came up in response to the summary judgment motion. At that time, in 2006, 2 years before the summary judgment that is being reviewed by this court, we specifically, in response to the statement of undisputed facts from the plaintiff, denied that there was a 72 recording. So the notion that it was until Mr. Muggerud's deposition they didn't know what was taken is something that's made up to try and excuse their delay in this case. And I can't explain why things worked the way that they did, why they, as the plaintiff, never checked their own copyright filing. It was a matter of public notice. Not only did they not check it, but the allegations that are made to the court below and to this court are not consistent with what's on the public record. Mr. Morrison got up in front of you this morning and said that while the song wasn't on the deposit copy, on the tape that was submitted, that it was on the list of songs. Well, the application is part of the record in this case, and it doesn't list any songs. So the notion that there is something filed which provides credence to the notion that this song was ever intended to be on that copyright filing is without any evidentiary foundation. As a matter of fact, a great deal, as Your Honor noted, of what Mr. Morrison was suggesting about the delays and what was going on is without evidentiary support. There's a lot of allegations about, oh, there were settlement discussions and, oh, there was a pretrial order. Well, that's not in the record, and it's not in the record for a reason. The defendants were moving forward with a summary judgment motion. We would not have incurred the expense if there was something that was going to obviate the need for this issue to be addressed at all. They put us through the efforts of completing discovery, of going for 2 years after Mr. Wright put them on notice that this song was not on the tape, was not part of the copyright application. Nobody on behalf of the plaintiff went and checked it. They said they didn't believe him. Well, I don't believe as a matter of law that's sufficient. If somebody comes in and says, I've checked the file, it's not there, I don't believe there's a 1972 copyright, and you just say, well, I don't believe him, I'm going to keep on going, that's the reason why Judge Norgel eventually said, I've had enough. This is 4+ years of litigation. You've had every opportunity under the sun. And let me back up 1 second. They also knew since 2006 that there was a separate copyright in the underlying composition of the song, because remember, there are two separate types of copyrights. There's one in the song as it's written on sheet music, and there's another one in the recorded performance. There was a separate consolidated action in which two other gentlemen were proceeding with a claim based on the composition copyright, saying they wrote it. And Mr. Johnson was also a co-writer. He never amended to add that claim. We went forward for 2 years after they brought their case with Mr. Johnson simply alleging a sound recording copyright in a copyright that didn't exist, despite being put on notice that that song was not part of the filing, despite being put on notice that there were other alternative claims. And let me add to that, if there was a question at the beginning of this case in the mind of the plaintiff that perhaps there was a 69 recording, perhaps there was a 72 recording, I'm not really sure what is the prudent course for any litigant to do, other than, of course, checking the copyright office, which they didn't do, and that is to plead the claims in the alternative.
There's a large amount of attorney's fees even at issue here.
Right.
And everybody keeps going on with I don't know, just from your side's point of view, mm-hmm. isn't there somewhere along the line that you guys tripped over this obvious glaring vacancy in this case that somebody, that this is a 19, you say you're already talking about the 1968 version.
Right.
Where's the gap that people are missing? This well, should have stopped a long time ago.
Yeah, I think that, I'm sorry. I think that that's a fair question. And I think that that tactically, we had made a motion for summary judgment in 2006. And we had made that motion based upon the existence of the license. When we started the lawsuit, before we started the lawsuit, remember, this Cypress Hill recording was released in 1993. So this is a decade after.
What was the commercial success? That was Black Sunday.
Yeah.
Just in the real world, what was the commercial success?
It was a successful album.
What would it have cost?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you fellas are in this business. But if you were to acknowledge that there was a copyright on that
right.
song at that, and you wanted to include that as interlude
right.
in this album,
right.
and you went to the copyright holder to get a license mm-hmm. to use it, what in real dollars here, what is something like that worth?
Not much. And that ties into the additional discovery on a misappropriation claim, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But that's a very important question, because one of the problems with this case, the plaintiff and the appellant tries to argue this as an issue of equity. And what this case really is a lottery ticket, because this song, if you want to even call it a song, was a minute and 17 seconds long. There was no lyrics on it.
And it's 25 years old.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you go back to 68.
Well, but what I'm saying is that the song Interlude was 1 minute and 17 seconds long. It wasn't even really a song. It was an instrumental break, hence called Interlude, between two commercial sound recordings. It was filler that was put on the album to take you from one track to another.
I understand, but just give me a ballpark number.
It
would go to somebody and say, we'd like to use this.
Well, I don't even have to guess.
68 or 72
yeah.
song in this album, and this is back in 1993. What do you have to pay to get?
Low five figures.
How much?
Low five figures, $10,000 to $25,000.
Is that what the license cost?
The license cost $25,000 in 2003 when we negotiated it with Sunlight. Because remember, this isn't really even a song. I mean, I think we had an expert in this case, and one of the points was there wasn't a single copy of this album that ever sold because of this interlude. The interlude was never played on the radio. It was filler sound between two commercial sound recordings. The problem is that the plaintiffs saw this, and instead of, and we're not going to talk about negotiations, viewed this as a multimillion-dollar claim, and that was part of the problem here. But if you're looking at the realities, Interlude was a non-event on this album. The license for that track, and what Mr. Morrison didn't tell you about Mr. Muggeroot's deposition testimony, is that he listed the samples that he used, and they are traditionally cleared. This one slipped through the cracks, so there was an error, and there is. You know, an issue because of that. But we're talking about very, very small amounts of money that are at issue here. To get back to Your Honor's question, because I don't want to evade your question, I think it's a valid one. We made a motion for summary judgment, and our motion was based on our assumption, which I believe still to this day to be the truth, that we had obtained a license from the copyright owner. There's a whole history between Mr. Johnson and Mr. Wright that went into a lot of litigations and played out. We were sort of a passive bystander in this. The first one who came up to us and said, hey, you have a problem here, was Peter Wright, and we settled with him on a reasonable commercial basis. When we filed for our summary judgment motion, after a period of time after the motion was submitted, Judge Norgel denied it, saying there was an issue of fact as to the commercial relationship between Mr. Wright and Mr. Johnson, and so he wasn't going to decide it as a matter of law at that point. So rather than turn around and file a second immediate summary judgment, we completed the discovery and filed our motion at that point. But the bottom line is that this claim, the claim that they pursued, they knew or should have known from 2003 had no legs, and that they were in a position to protect themselves. They never did it. They were advised in 2006 that they had a problem with it. They didn't change it. Their co-plaintiffs advised them that there was a composition claim out there. They didn't fix it. Even after Mr. Muggerud testified, we filed our motion for summary judgment 4 months later. In that interim, they did nothing. So throughout this process, there was, as the court below found, an extraordinary amount of delay. You know, Mr. Morrison said there wasn't any real delay. There were 4.5 years, and the trial court, which has the best familiarity with this record, looked at it and said there was an extraordinary delay. There was no tenable excuse for why it took that long. I believe that this is something that changes the direction of the case right before trial. As this court had addressed in the Johnson versus Methodist Medical Center case, and I'm not going to permit it. And he also found that it would require discovery and that there would be prejudice to the defendants as a result of that amendment. Now, one of the reasons why the review of a leave to amend is an abuse of discretion standard is because it's an impossible burden to put on a circuit court to evaluate the record on a motion to amend, to look at all of the discovery that has taken place, to make a determination as to whether that was sufficient to cover the new claims, whether the defendant is going to be prejudiced. There are a lot of allegations on that point in the appellant's brief without any evidentiary citations whatsoever, just like there are about the settlement and how everybody was playing nice. I'm sorry?
What more would you need if the case were to go forward on the state law claim?
I think that the biggest issue is that the Illinois action for misappropriation is not a tremendously well-defined claim, but because there haven't been that many cases arising under it. This court had a Chicago Board of Trade case, which we cited in our brief, which gave a very fulsome explanation of the policy considerations of it. But what does seem to be clear, both from Illinois misappropriation and other state law claims that are the parallel of the for protecting sound recordings before 73, is that they focus on the injury to the plaintiff, that they are not profit-oriented recoveries, but rather they look at what would he have gotten for the license, were his commercial opportunities with regard to his property damaged. The entire focus of the damage case in this particular situation would have been completely revamped and had to be redone. And I believe that the trial court was in the best position to address that, looking at the discovery that had taken place, and that's the reason for the standard that we have right now. But, you know, when you look at a motion to amend, you look at the delay, which this court in the Soltis case and many other cases has said is a major factor in evaluating it, that the longer the delay, the greater the presumption against granting leave. Many cases from this court have found inordinate delay based on the delay of several months. For example, even the time period between Mr. Muggerud's deposition and the filing of the...
Mr. Byrd, let me, if I could, interrupt you for a second and ask you about a bottom line that I frankly find pretty troubling, and I'd like you to tell me about it from your point of view. What we have here, as I understand it, at the end of the day, is that the guy whose work was copied deliberately and without what turned out to be a valid license has been ordered to pay the guys who copied more than $300,000 in legal fees. How is that appropriate?
Well, I think it's only appropriate because of the litigation history of this case. I think that you start off with the presumption that someone has a claim, they try to make a commercial resolution of it, and failing that, they pursue their legal rights in a way that comports with their obligations as litigants in this court. And by failing to do that, you take what was simply an issue of rights and convert it into an abuse of the judicial process and an imposition of costs, which is unwarranted. And what the plaintiffs did in this case was not simply to say we were wronged, but to, without authority, without checking, sticking their heads in the sand, proceed for over 4 years with a claim that with any reasonable duty to inquire, which I think is implied on the litigant under the federal rules, to proceed and to impose costs on everyone. And I think that but for that, the result would have been inequitable. But I don't think that you can strip away the plaintiff's conduct in litigating this case from the end result, because it wasn't Mr. Johnson in 2003 who's being told to pay money and to walk away and to have nothing. It's Mr. Johnson in 2008 where, despite all the warnings in the world, he has imposed costs and prejudiced parties and used the legal system as a way of whether it was as a way or not, but his use of the legal system caused real significant damage. And when you therefore look at the two basic issues in this case, because in essence the appellant has conceded that there isn't a basis for arguing that the dismissal was not on the merits, or that attorney's fees shouldn't have been granted under the copyright law if attorney's fees are going to be granted, there are two basic issues here. One, should leave to amend have been denied? And I think that, yes, leave to amend should be denied under all the applicable standards of this court, because there was an unreasonable delay. There was no excuse for the delay. The trial court evaluated this and sat in on it and decided that there would be prejudice as a result of it, and that it was, after 4.5 years, as the case is proceeding to trial, too late in the day to be making a change in direction. Then the second issue is, once that happens, what is the res judicata effect of that initial determination? And those are issues of law for this court to decide. And one of the problems that the plaintiffs have in this case is that they argue, for purposes of res judicata, that the issues are different, that, you know, they're not bound by the finding of summary judgment by Judge Norgel in the first instance because their second claims are different from their first ones. Then they turn around and say, but they're the same and it causes no prejudice when it comes to the motion to amend. They're riding two horses simultaneously.
You've got the same two horses to ride.
I absolutely do, and that's right on point, but there is a critical difference. And that difference is that for purposes of res judicata, identity of claims is defined as the same core of operative facts. And so we do have the same core of operative facts for purposes of res judicata, and therefore identical claims for that purpose under that analysis, and can still claim that the claims are different in terms of their proof, in terms of their discovery, and in terms of the costs that are imposed on us as a result of having to proceed after this inordinate delay. So at the end of the day, I think there was never any good faith question as to what recording was at issue. There is no good faith issue with regard to their failure to exercise the due diligence that's required of them as a matter of law. And they can't shuffle off the burden for their own decisions and their own inactions on us by saying, look at the position we're in, when it was curable by them by pleading in the alternative, by amending when it was appropriate, by checking the Copyright Office, by taking simple, obvious steps that any prudent litigator would take to protect its position.
Therefore,
I ask that the decision be affirmed. Thank you.
Mr. Morrison, rebuttal. How much time? 2 minutes? Okay. 2 minutes.
Everything that happened in the main case, in the case that the summary judgment was entered, every bit of discovery that was taken, every issue that was explored has relevance to the state court case. This isn't a situation in which we have widely divergent sets of facts, sets of theories. This is the same case. We have the same parties. We have the same violation. We have the same damages. If there are some differences that need a little bit of discovery, that does come with an amended complaint. Yes, occasionally you do have to take a little more discovery. Not massive amounts of discovery, not far and wide and far-ranging discovery. Judge Norgal, unfortunately, for the purpose for here, sent this case out to the magistrate judge at the beginning for discovery. Judge Norgal didn't have any idea, really, what discovery was done in this case. He alleged that there was a protracted and hostile discovery. That had nothing to do with us. The protracted and hostile discovery dealt with the third-party complaint. There was a lot of problems between Peter Wright and the defendants. In fact, that's what that 06 declaration was all about. That wasn't in our case, really. That was based on the license.
When did you learn about the license? Supposedly, the 1969 version.
We learned about the license.
They say they alleged that at some point early on.
Whenever it was that they filed the third-party complaint. What they did was they filed a third-party complaint saying, we got a license from Peter Wright, and if that and there's a there was a clause in there that if they ended up having to pay money as a result of that copyright or a result of using that song, Peter Wright would be responsible for it. So they filed a third-party complaint. That's when we learned about the license.
That disposed of the license and that version. That's all I'm saying. That's the first time that version was mentioned, and everyone's thinking it's the 72 version for some reason.
We still thought it was the 72 version.
Even with that?
Even with that.
There was a license?
First of all, the license was with a company called Sunlight Records, which was founded 20 years later and had no relationship whatsoever to either of the songs. Those were Sill's songs. Those were Mr. Johnson's songs. They weren't Peter Wright's songs. That's what the issue was about. Who had the right to this song? Not whether it was the 68 version or the 72
version.
It was who had the right to "Is It Because I'm Black." That's what
Thank you, Mr. Morrison.
Thank you very much.
The case is taken under advisement.